headlines this hour. Russia's president, in a meeting with the Syrian counterpart, slams the presence of illegitimate foreign forces in Syria as a hindrance to the Arab country's consolidation. Palestinians in an Al-Quds district go on a commercial strike, solidarity with Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. And southern Chinese cities close schools and order testing for millions in a race to curb a new COVID-19 outbreak. Well, welcome to our studios near the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has hailed the Syrian government's control over much of the Arab country. Putin made the comments as he met with the Syrian counterpart, Bashar al-Assad, in the Russian capital, Moscow. The Russian president said that the government in Damascus is now in control of more than 90% of the Syrian territory. Putin said Syria's problem is the presence of what he called illegitimate foreign troops on its soil. He added those forces deployed without a UN decision are a hindrance for Syria's consolidation. The meeting between Putin and Assad follows recent gains by the Syrian army in the southwestern province of Daraa. The army has regained two key areas from foreign-backed militants there. A group of Palestinians have gone on a strike in occupied Al-Quds in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. Palestinians have stopped working in Isawiya neighborhood of Al-Quds. They have slammed Israel's treatment of Palestinian inmates and called on the international community to take action. On Monday, nearly 1,400 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails announced an open-ended hunger strike. They said that their action will begin on Friday. The inmates want the Israeli regime to end what they see as a policy of oppression and abuse against prisoners. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have also held a rally in solidarity with thousands of inmates inside Israeli jails. The Hezbollah Secretary General Seyed Hassan Nasrallah has announced that a ship carrying fuel from Iran has arrived in Syria's Banias port. He added that the transfer of the ship into Lebanon would begin on Thursday. Mariam Saleh has more from Beirut.
Hezbollah Secretary General Seyed Hassan Nasrallah said on Monday that the first Iranian fuel shipment has reached the Banias port in Syria and will be transported by land to Lebanon this week.
The transport of fuel from Syria to the Bekaa begins Thursday, and it will be stored in specific tanks, and a second ship will arrive in Banias within a few days. The third ship, which I have mentioned before, is being prepared. All managerial prerequisites have been accomplished, so the vessel will be ready to sail. We're also preparing the logistics for the fourth shipment. About a month later, we'll see if we need a fifth or sixth ship. I have to clarify that we don't seek any gains in this fuel. We prefer all Lebanese and everyone who lives in Lebanon.
In his televised speech, Sayyid Nasrallah noted that Hezbollah will offer a one-month fuel donation to state-run hospitals, nursing homes, orphanages, disability centers, state-run water institutions, municipalities that have water wells, the civil defense, and the Lebanese Red Cross. Experts believe the speech highlights a roadmap Hezbollah has put forth to alleviate the fuel crisis the Lebanese people are dealing with, in light of the government's inactivity and at the same time challenges pressures imposed by the West against the nation.
Hezbollah's decision to bring in fuel and even warn the enemies that it will be considered Lebanese assets and that any strike on the ships will lead to retaliation was a very influential issue. It dealt a blow to the U.S. sanctions, whether against Iran, Syria, or Lebanon. The fact that the ship has reached its destination safely and has unloaded its cargo is in itself a victory.
The Hezbollah chief stressed that the resistance's deterrence power kept the ship safe. He said once the shipment reaches its destination, the fuel will be distributed carefully to prevent any potential profit seekers from taking advantage.
Lebanon has been sleeping in the dark for many nights. Sayyid Nasrallah has stressed that Hezbollah's initiative to bring in fuel to Lebanon from Iran will not only bring electricity, but will also break the current U.S. sanctions against the country. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The British government has threatened to suspend the Northern Ireland Protocol agreed with the European Union under the Brexit deal last year. Brexit Minister Lord Frost said London is ready to take the step if the European Commission refuses to renegotiate the document. His comments came after the ruling party in Northern Ireland threatened to collapse the regional parliament over the protocol. The European Commission has said the renegotiating of the Northern Ireland protocol will lead to more instability for people and businesses. The document has already created massive problems for Britain's Northern Ireland by imposing checks on the transit of goods with EU member Ireland. The UK has so far voluntarily kept the checks suspended. Syed Pour is our correspondent joining us from London. We also have Jerome Hughes, who's our correspondent joining us from Brussels. First over to you, Syed, if I may. Maybe it's a good time to refresh what this Northern Ireland protocol is and where the controversy is all about, because many may not have a recollection of what this is all about.
The Northern Ireland Protocol, COVID, came into effect. It was agreed upon, rather, by the two sides to allow the flow of goods into the European Union without a border between the Republic of Ireland, an EU member, and Northern Ireland, which is one of the devolved nations in the UK, and also primarily to protect the 1998 Good Friday Agreement that put an end to 30 years of what is referred to as the troubles between the nationalists / Republicans who wanted to reunify Northern Ireland with the Republic of Ireland and the royalists / unionists who wish to remain as part of the United Kingdom. The sticking points, one of them is right now what the UK is trying to change, for example, is the purview of the European Court of Justice, the highest court of the European Union, and the supreme interpreter of the rules and laws that govern the single market. So if that were to happen, Northern Ireland obviously is subject to those rules. What the Northern Ireland government, we heard the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party, say a few days ago, and the recent announcement from the UK is a reaction to, I believe, that is, they're saying, look, it was agreed upon without, quote, democratic input from the people of Northern Ireland, and the only reason that we haven't felt the full impact of the accord is that it hasn't been fully implemented, and because of the grace periods that have been extended unilaterally by the United Kingdom, I think two or three times, the most recent one, I think last month. So what is happening is they're saying, look, we're not very happy with this. They're piling the pressure on the UK as well as the EU to come to some kind of an agreement. The Europeans are saying to the UK, look, if you didn't like this agreement, why did you sign on to it? It's going to stay the same. We're not going to really renegotiate the deal. But the UK, as you can see in this recent announcement, they're saying, look, it cannot continue in its present shape and form.
Okay, that's a great question that Syed raises there, Jerome, that the EU has posed to the UK. So tell us, I'm sure there's got to be consequences if there's going to be a renegotiation of some kind, I'm not sure. And tell us what would happen if there was no results or no results were obtained from a renegotiation if it didn't happen. What would happen? For example, I'm reading this piece of news that talks about how supermarket shelves are running low if that's one of the consequences.
Well, I think, Cathay, certainly the EU side will want to pursue all the diplomatic channels as much as possible before we get to the point of an absolute crisis. And we're likely to hear a lot more from the EU side tomorrow, Wednesday, because Ursula von der Leyen is going to deliver the annual State of the Union address. And traditionally, this is address, it's less candid, it's more candid, you know, it's more pointed, it's perhaps less diplomatic in its tone. And speaking to officials here in Brussels, I've been told that Ursula von der Leyen is certainly going to address this issue during her speech in the European Parliament tomorrow, Wednesday. And apparently she's likely to talk about the importance of these international treaties and hint at the damage that was done to the reputation of the United States during the Trump era. And, you know, during every speech that we hear from a senior official or even many of the prime ministers here in the EU, they always keep talking now about the need for the EU to become more autonomous, to become more independent, and that's always sort of hinting towards the Trump era, Trump era and the damage done there. So this is what she's likely to talk about, in the sense that, you know, administrations change. Boris Johnson's administration will change eventually, but actually it can do bad reputational damage and long-term political implications for a country if you just walk away from international treaties. And the Northern Ireland Protocol is underpinned by international law, and this is the point she's going to make. And of course, treaties can be renegotiated over long periods of time through the diplomatic channels, but just walking away from something or ignoring the legality of something, that does create damage to a country. And so, you know, and also the point is, you know, we're going to hear from the UK side more and more that there's political pressure, because we've had a change of leadership in the DUP, which is the main sort of unionist party in Northern Ireland, and Geoffrey Donaldson is more hardline than Arlene Foster. And so we're going to hear that he's putting a lot of pressure on London, because the DUP are furious and they wanted Geoffrey Donaldson in there to make the point that, look, you cannot do anything that differentiates Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK. But the EU side is saying, look, if you're going to be bringing goods from the from mainland or from England into another part of the UK, i.e. Northern Ireland, there has to be border checks, because we don't want a hard border on the island of Ireland between the Republic, which is in the EU, and Northern Ireland. So the alternative is this protocol where we have a border effectively in the Irish Sea, but effectively that means border checks on the coastline of Northern Ireland. But the DUP just do not want this. The fact that there's checks happening on goods, or should be checks happening on goods coming from the other parts of the UK into Northern Ireland, that they don't want that. So, you know, this is going to play out. We don't know how it's going to play out, but we're likely to hear tough words tomorrow from Ursula von der Leyen. And it's going to be scathing criticism, I think, of Boris Johnson and his government for trying to row back, for trying to just scrap this this agreement and use it in all sorts of excuses like the pandemic. I mean, this is another thing that's going to be talked about. You cannot blame the pandemic on everything. There have been lots of things have functioned relatively normally during the pandemic. So just to say that what we're hearing from the British government saying about, you know, the pandemic has changed things, and using this as an excuse, and using the political situation in Northern Ireland as an excuse with the changed landscape in the DUP, this will not wash from the EU's perspective.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We appreciate it, Saifur. It's our pleasure. Correspondent there talking to us from London. Jerome Hughes, it's been a while. It's good to talk to you, our correspondent, talking to us there from Brussels. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Welcome back. China has closed schools and ordered testing for millions in Fujian province following a new COVID outbreak there. All schools in the city of Fujian have stopped in-person classes. Public venues like cinemas and gyms have also been shut. The nearby city of Xiamen has followed suit and shut down long-distance bus services. Fujian province in southeast China reported 59 new locally transmitted cases on Tuesday. They were up from 22 infections a day earlier. The outbreak began in Fujian on September 10 and spread to two other cities since then. Total infections are now 102. Authorities say that the cluster's suspected patient zero was a man who had recently returned from Singapore. The U.S. has expressed its willingness to hold talks with North Korea after Pyongyang tested a new long-range cruise missile over the weekend. The White House said its position toward North Korea has not changed and that it remains prepared to engage with the East Asian nation. Pyongyang says its nuclear and ballistic programs are essential to defend the country against the U.S. invasion. Talks aimed at denuclearizing the North collapsed in 2019 after the U.S. failed to lift sanctions. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has faced a grilling at Congress over the troop withdrawal from Afghanistan.
I want to know how many Afghan citizens came to the United States that had not met the qualifications for a special immigrant visa.
We're in the process of
How many did you bring? You were just at Dulles. How many did you bring?
We will have, by the end of the month, we will have brought a total of approximately 60,000.
That have not met the SIV process.
Some of those will have been through the SIV process. All of them, regardless of SIV status, will have gone through rigorous security checks.
It'd be nice if that was done before we brought these people to the United States of America.
Blinken was answering questions at a House Foreign Affairs Committee hearing where he faced strong criticism over the developments in Afghanistan. The top U.S. diplomat defended President Joe Biden's decision to withdraw forces before the August 31st deadline. Blinken, however, blamed the administration of former President Donald Trump for signing a deal with the Taliban. He noted that the Biden administration inherited a deadline for the pullout and not a plan. Foreign troops scrambled to leave Afghanistan last month, putting an end to the 20-year-long war in the Central Asian country. Political commentator Jason Unruh believes the U.S. president could have come up with a better arrangement for the Taliban to withdraw American troops from Afghanistan.
Well, he could have renegotiated, but I don't think that's something that the United States is willing to do. I mean, breaking agreements is nothing new for the U.S., so I don't see why they think that they would lose face in any way by doing so. It is something that they do very commonly, but it wouldn't have taken very much just to sit down with the Taliban and say, okay, we need a little bit more time to get everything out. We are leaving. You can see that we're leaving. We definitely are. We just want to get the rest of our equipment out. And then they could have made some kind of offer, maybe cut back on the rhetoric on trying to block foreign aid to Afghanistan. We could have made a simple donation. Okay, maybe if you let us pull our stuff out, maybe give us a week extension to get rid of all our equipment, we'll send you X amount of food aid. And I think that would have been perfectly acceptable.
The U.S. National Weather Service says the Gulf Coast of Texas and Louisiana face a life-threatening situation as Hurricane Nicholas batters the region with heavy rains. Nicholas is now strengthened from a tropical storm to a hurricane. Millions of residents are under storm surge, flood, and tropical storm warnings. As it moves northeast, Nicholas is expected to dump heavy rain on parts of south-central Louisiana and southern Mississippi. The U.S. President Joe Biden has declared an emergency for Louisiana. Officials have warned that Hurricane Nicholas could knock out electricity and disrupt restoration efforts in Louisiana. The southeastern state is still reeling from destruction caused by another hurricane, Ida, that hit a couple weeks ago. With that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
A simple question.
The Ministry of Defence in central London has been busy since 2001. That's when the United Kingdom and America invaded Afghanistan to drive out Taliban forces. Some say this politically motivated escapade owed as much to gesture politics as it did to any military objective. After initial success in limiting the area of operations of the Taliban, the battle for hearts and minds began to be lost as the attempt to win through military power failed the West.
Britain has been closely involved with the campaign in Afghanistan. It is, in fact, just an example of similar initiatives involving Britain in Iraq, Libya, Yemen, and Syria. There is no sign that the British government will shift away from this militaristic approach as the UK struggles to adapt its international strategies in a new world order where it is not as powerful as it once was. All this war has damaged these countries in economic, social, and political ways. The public are deprived of health, housing, and safety. Businesses fail. Politicians compete to control anarchic and angry populations with the ever-present prospect of insurgency. Since the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, has been key to much of this action, some argue NATO has served to destabilize the entire Middle East, while making Britain more of a target for enemies.
So what was the result of this and other military escapades in the Middle East and the surrounding region? Will the UK choose peaceful solutions in future? Or is the financial incentive just too great for the UK to give up on the arms industry? These are simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. How do people here in central London feel about the UK's military involvement in Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, Yemen, and Iraq? We've put that to the public. Here's what they told us.
I don't think the British public know enough about what's going on there. I myself, I used to live in the Middle East. I know nothing about any kind of wars or any bad. I was an Emirate. I was in the Emirates, and I was an expat there, and I knew nothing but positivity and just so, I'm so accepted by the Emirati people, and yet we hear all this stuff about Iran and Iraq and all this Afghanistan, but what is actually happening? What is the problem? I don't feel like I know.
Well, to be honest, as a country, we've always got involved in everybody else's problems as a way to benefit this country, and it's about time we stop sticking their nose in.
I think UK should put more active participation. I don't think the country is doing enough in terms of global causes. So my view is that it should, being a superpower, it should rather be taking into account what's going around as well. Yeah. So that's, they might be doing it to a certain extent, but that's not enough with whatever is happening around. So.
Well, I'm born in Afghanistan, so I kind of was at first hand at the situation there, my parents, how they had to flee, and we've obviously come over here to start a new life. I get it from a government point of view. We've got to take action. When there are regimes like the Taliban that unfortunately, at the cost of civilians and normal people, need to be addressed, they need to be challenged. But at the same time, in the last 20 years, the occupation, the alliance forces, how much good have they done? And now that they're leaving, what will that leave? What legacy will that leave? So I'm kind of, I don't know enough to kind of say one way or the other. I am skeptical, but also I appreciate the intervention is necessary because there are countries where, you know, leaders, dictators go on and on for decades. They don't take the country forward. So I appreciate the intervention, but I don't know if it was in the last 20 years.
Our involvement in all those wars has always been a disaster. I think we first invaded Afghanistan 200 years ago. There's never been anything in any of those wars that hasn't left a worse position. Hundreds of thousands of people killed, and usually chaos. I was born in 1945. I grew up in that post-war world where we were told all our wars were about trying to create a democracy. They weren't. They're about getting control of oil in the Middle East and making money out of all of these things. We never created a democracy anyway.
The 21st century has been a century of war. for Britain. In fact, the last years of the 20th century were also in the era of Tony Blair and Bill Clinton and the so-called Chicago Doctrine, the so-called right to protect, although they're highly discriminating in whom they intend to protect, and of course end up killing vast numbers of people in order to protect them, like the famous American general in Vietnam, in the Vietnam War, who said we had to destroy that village in order to save it. It has been a colossal blunder, as well as a terrifically large crime, one of the great crimes of British history, and we have many crimes in British history. The invasion and occupation of first Afghanistan, then Iraq, the destruction of Libya, the attempt to destroy Syria, the participation in the no war but no peace with Iran, the participation in the attacks on the poorest people in the region in Yemen, have all been a shameful mark on the British record, which, as I say, has many centuries of such marks.
What does the public feel was actually achieved by the UK's military action in and around the Middle East over the last 20 years?
Well, we haven't achieved anything. So my husband was out there, fought in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we're now looking at, we're going back again. So we haven't achieved anything. It's done full circle. So we haven't got anywhere. Hasn't done anything.
They just continue to disrupt it. That's all the intention is. I'm not particularly very happy with the way that we kind of manage ourselves and what we've done in the Middle East. It's not very good.
Nothing at all. Like I said, I've never heard any good come out of it. We're going, keep going back and spending all this money. I don't know on what at all. So nothing at all.
Oh, you should ask my son who studied GCSE. You know, he was taught, this is what he studied, which was the Middle East and, you know, from, you know, Ben Gurion and all the setting up of that. To be honest, it seems to be it's dominated by the American politics, not necessarily British politics, but by supporting, I suppose, Americans. The British are seen as being complicit in terms of what they're doing. What do I think? As I said, there are sides to both. There are both sides in terms of what there are, you know.
The Middle East hasn't moved on a whole lot in the last 20 years, but the UK has been involved for 800 years in many different places. It depends on, as I said, the purpose. If you're not seeing any improvements, you have to question why you're there.
If I think back, we have never been involved anywhere in the Middle East that hasn't been a disaster. I grew up really worried that one day I'd have to join the army and I'd be sent. I grew up really worried that I'd be forced into the army, I'd end up in a war somewhere in the Middle East. And the simple fact is that literally all this has been about the control of oil, not about democracy or defending people's rights. We have been responsible, along with America. We've been the number two in this. America's been the main lead in all this. And hundreds of thousands of people have died because of it, and we've ended up with a legacy of really unpleasant dictatorial regimes. Where in the Middle East have we created a nice democracy? We haven't.
Well, nothing good has been achieved for Britain, that's for sure. The demonstration that I talked about, which is a demonstration of the United States' fading power rather than growing power, has pushed people together, for example, that might not otherwise have ended up together. It's pushed Russia and China together, almost as one country, economically speaking, currency-wise, militarily. It has, in strategic politics, it has pushed China and Russia together, making a very powerful adversary indeed. It has emboldened fanatic Takfiri extremism all over the world, including in our own country. I've just been reading the inquest details of the Takfiri murderer who went wild in a street I used to live in, a man who had been in maximum security from the age of 16 and by the age of 20 was dead, but having stabbed multiple innocent people in between those two dates. It has, of course, created a new bloc in the world, which involves Iran, China, Russia, Venezuela, Cuba, and so on, which will not be in the United States' imperial interest to have done.
The UK is a pivotal part of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, that's NATO. But with all this military activity, when it comes to keeping the British public safe, has the UK's involvement in NATO done more harm than good?
To be honest, I just think we're in it because we're Britain, and that's it. We have to be part of it. I don't think we achieve anything from it. It's just to say that we're involved in it, but America will just do whatever they can for themselves, I think.
It's hard to say. I mean, you look at the July attack, you look at 2000, obviously, in the US, and you look at lots of the terrorist attacks. Where does it come from? Where does it boil down to? And it's, you know, individuals, again, making that decision based on perhaps an ideology, their own personal views, and they go and act. So would a government decision or would a treaty like the NATO treaty prevent that? I don't know. And when it was set up, it was a great idea. And again, I appreciate what it can help with, but does it go far enough? Are these people that are sitting around talking about these situations and then putting the actions in place, is it going far enough to really drive into the root cause of these individuals that are acting?
I believe they should. I mean, every country should have the have a freedom to equip themselves, but as long as it's been used for summoning the borders, not for sort of putting pressure on other countries. Yeah. So yes, every country has the right to sort of equip themselves with whatever weapons and whatever things they need to do to secure their boundaries. So I have no problem with that. Yeah.
If anything, we seem to be going in the opposite direction in the last 10 years. Maybe in the early years there was some improvements, but it's definitely stoked fires, not just the UK, everybody's involvement, because there's different purposes for you being there. And in short, no, in the recent years, it's probably getting worse. And that's because any time you step into somebody's territory and use certain tactics, you're going to upset people. You don't have to go too far. You can come back locally and realize that if you continue with the same policies that don't seem to be working, you're going to upset people, and people will start to turn around and see what they can do. And if there isn't another power, another government that can support them, they'll start to take on that pressure themselves and revolt.
Basically, when NATO was set up just after the end of the Second World War, we were being told we were under a threat from the Soviet Union, Russia. And we now know, given all the data has been released, there was never a threat. Stalin had no intention of attacking the West. This was all about creating this military complex so we controlled Europe, not the Soviet Union. And the simple fact is people should have been allowed to create their own governments in their own time. We were involved in so many wars throughout all my life. It's been every single one of them. It's been not about democracy. It's been about economic interests.
Britain's involvement in NATO is an extremely expensive way of defending ourselves, even though we, in fact, have no discernible enemies that could attack us beyond the very Takfiri extremist terrorists that we have been doing so much to help in places like Libya, in places like Syria. NATO is no defense at all against a man with a samurai sword in a park going around cutting people's heads off. Britain has no nuclear enemy, and no country, no state, which is conceivably going to pose a risk to British security. So we're paying a lot of money and paying a high political price for being involved with, you call it NATO, but it's really just the United States' gang, you know, and it would be quickly dispensed with if other NATO countries began to oppose American adventurism in Latin America, for example. Not many people know that that well-known North Atlantic power, Colombia, is currently a candidate member for NATO. But if any country or group of countries began to oppose NATO's involvements in different parts of the world, it would quickly be dispensed with. This is the United States' coalition of the killing.
The direct cost to America of the Afghanistan conflict is estimated at $2 trillion. In terms of death toll, in Libya, deaths are estimated at 30,000. The figure in Afghanistan is over 115,000 dead. In Yemen, the number exceeds 130,000. For Syria, those killed has passed 500,000. And for Iraq, it exceeds 600,000. Thus, the total official estimate of dead in these five countries alone is 1.375 million. This is almost certainly an underestimate.
After 20 years of war in Afghanistan and elsewhere, does the public think the UK will choose a more peaceful approach in the future, or will the next 20 years just be more of the same?
Not really. I have a cousin who works in the army in Israel, and it looks like it's something that's going to keep going on forever. There's always some sort of massive thing breaking out, and loads of people are dying and feeling terrified. So, I don't know.
When you go into a country to make things better, but have a backdoor deal to sell arms, and that may not be directly, maybe indirectly going back to that source country as well, you have to question it.
I don't think so. Human nature, you know, we have this territorial kind of ideology, or I don't know. I guess it's a person's survival of the fittest. Sorry, the Darwin's theory, and we group together, and we want to have our own sort of space. And I think we should educate ourselves a bit better. We should help each other, support each other. And hopefully bring about change within ourselves in order to impact the environment, the community that we live in. And we'll be living in a better place, but I don't know if we'll ever remove conflict, because that's just human nature.
More the same. I can't see this ending. I can't see how this is actually going to end. Like I said, I think it's just going to constantly just go round in circles. There is just no end to this, is there? Now we've started it, how do you end a war once you've started a war? There is no end, is there? It's tit for tat. It's just going to keep going round and round.
Well, it's quite clear, now that America's pulled out, we've decided to pull out, it's going to be up to the people in Afghanistan. The trouble is, I'm not a supporter of the Taliban, of course. I mean, and imposing a religion on people is wrong. I want to live in a world where everyone is free to live their life as they choose. Not to be told you've got to support this religion, that religion, live this or that life. Just let people be themselves.
Unfortunately, I think the next 20 years will be very much like the last 20 years. Beyond 20, no one could safely hazard a guess. But we are locked into this alliance with the United States. The United States is fading, but still dangerous. Even the broken teeth of an old tiger can bite. And as long as we're locked into being the tail of that old tiger, I'm afraid we'll have to follow the head.
The UK is the second biggest arms dealer in the Middle East behind America. How will British arms exports be affected following the global economic problems caused by COVID? And is Britain even more dependent on the arms trade now?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely it does. There's a lot of decisions that are driven by, and there's a lot of things that come out of that. You know, stopping that, would it prevent the wars that are happening, and would it prevent some of the issues that are in these countries, in Middle East, in Afghanistan, in other countries? I don't know. But certainly, again, the government needs to be taken into account for those actions and those trades and transactions. I understand that we're an economy. I understand that the life situation here is better. You know, if I was in Afghanistan and I'd grown up in Afghanistan, the education that I would have had would mean nothing compared to what I have had living in the UK. And I'm very grateful for that. But again, it needs to be taken into account and it needs to be challenged, and we need to talk about it more and be more aware of it moving forward.
Well, I think probably it's going to mean that countries have seemed to be more worried about it themselves because they've got to look after what's happening in their own countries. So they're maybe not looking and keeping an eye on what's going abroad very much because, you know, the pandemic causes huge issues in your own country.
I hope not. I mean, I don't know too much about it, but I definitely hope that people will realise that it's not the way forward. But yeah, like I said, I don't really know much about it. But I don't think that it's a productive use of forces and money.
Well, we're not financially reliant. It's quite small as a proportion of our national economy. But the simple fact is, if you look at this, half of all the military spending in the world is by the United States of America. I mean, literally, every other country in the world together just equals what America spends on its military. And the tragedy is, all throughout most of my life, British governments, Labour or Conservative, have just been going along with what America wants. Fortunately, for my generation, the then Labour government, Harold Wilson, refused to get involved in the war in Vietnam. Otherwise, you wouldn't be interviewing me now. I'd be dead.
Well, where there's muck, there's brass, we say in this country. Where there are dirty things, there's money to be made. In this case, where there's brass in the form of arms exports, there's muck to be gathered. And the muck may be lucre, but it's filthy lucre. And I don't expect that to change. It's a symptom of Britain's industrial and manufacturing decline that just about the best things that we make nowadays are weapons. Weapons which, in the end, pierce the skin and the heads of overwhelmingly innocent people. A man's just gone to prison in the United States of America for 4 years for exposing the fact that drones, kind of drones we routinely make and routinely sell and see you routinely used, kill 90% innocent civilians. There's blood on the hands of Britain's weapons manufacturers, but they're not going to stop or go out of business anytime soon.
Since 2001, the UK has backed conflict in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Yemen, and Syria. Britain is also the second largest arms exporter to the Middle East. Britain has therefore made literally billions of pounds worth of business through the sale and use of weapons in these countries and beyond.
Years and countless deaths later, with the Taliban once again advancing in Afghanistan and the region in conflict, Britain has made a fortune out of war, but at the cost of lives and peace. The UK could change course tomorrow, but some suggest that for Britain PLC, war is just too profitable to let peace get in the way.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
Humanity.
سيد عبد الله الموسوي.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program for humanity. In previous episodes, we were speaking about corruption, and the episode just before that, we were talking about the causes of corruption. Now, if you want to understand what is the relationship between corruption and human rights, then I do suggest and I emphasize on the fact that you should listen to the rest of these episodes. They're short, they're quite informative, and hopefully you might learn something. We said the first cause of corruption is greed, which is an inner drive and desire which drives me to do the wrong to achieve gains, be it materialistic or be it in the form of matter or be it in the form of a mental satisfaction. So it drives me to do such a form. And even though religiously it's haram, by law it's forbidden, and so on and so forth. So that's the first one. Two, low economic freedom. Now, that's also a major drive for corruption, which I will repeat the phrase. That when I deal in these things, obviously it means I am taking the right of someone else. Therefore, the name of the program, hence the name of the program, for humanity. So we need to work for humanity, not deprive the humanity. When there's a low income, or the economy itself, it is low, when we have a low economic freedom, which means the governments, the systems, impose restrictions on me trading and dealing, then I seem to tend to go towards means to gain wealth in a quick way. Why? Because the government puts so much regulations. In some governments, you see that if you want to get, for example, a license of some sort, if you want to get a certificate of some sort, they make it a living hell. The process for you to get a license or to get a certificate or to get a business name or a business number or what have you. You see, the government, they put so much restrictions, so much limitations, that one usually is forced to bribe his way out, which is a form of corruption. I remember recently a friend of mine came and said, like, you know what, I'm having a problem doing such a thing. And I had no other choice but to bribe such a person in such a position with silver and gold and, you know, necklaces for his kids to get him to give me what I want. Now, that's a problem. Now, my friend, obviously, he's mistaken in his approach. But the person who is accepting is also creating what? Corruption on earth. Corruption in the system. And the problem, this comes from where? The fact that we don't have much freedom when it comes to the economy. I can't deal, I can't sell, I can't buy. And those who are dealing and trading and buying and selling, you see, they are the ones who have the upper hand in a way or another. You know, they have connection, they have means. And then, as we say, they hoard the market. They became the driving force to the market, and no one can compete with them. And even if a small business comes out to the public, they will buy it out, or at least they will fight it until such a business will go out of business, as we say. So you can see that such low economic freedom, it affects the human rights in the fact that it causes what? More corruption. This is something that we need to be aware of, that we need to fight when it comes to me or to my community. Let us take a break and we will look at the other causes of corruption.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are still listening to the program For Humanity. So we said one of the reasons for corruption is the fact there is low economic freedom. Three, weak property rights. When I don't have a place to live in, when the government does not give me a piece of land, or at least they don't provide me with a cheap piece of land to buy or to own, be it a land or a house, a business, or what have you. When the property that I want to own, when the rights are very weak when it comes to this regard, then obviously that becomes a driving force for me to do what? To go right and left trying to seek gains. Basically, corruption in the form of bribery, in the form of, I don't know, what have you, you think of it. So there's a sense of what corruption happening when people find that they are facing a wall and they can't move forward, will obviously lead them to throw the rope and try to jump that wall in a way or another. So that is a cause of corruption within communities. Four, poverty itself. When people are poor, when you live in a society, for example, if you look at the statistics in America, for example, you have so many people under the line of poverty. And in some cities, I've been told, some states, they have, you know, 50%, I don't want to name names, obviously, 50% of such a state, which looked up at highly around the world because Hollywood makes it sound very fancy, 50% of such population are in poverty, and a lot of them are homeless. In some suburbs, the entire suburbs are homeless people. So poverty itself, when people are poor, obviously means there is a high form of corruption on a high level. So when such a state or such suburbs are poor and you got so much homeless people, it means the councils that are running such a suburb or the government that are running such a state obviously are corrupted, because people are not getting their rights and causes poverty. And people who are poor, obviously they themselves will be corrupted as well. I mean, they will be corrupted on a moral level, because if a person is poor, obviously amongst the things that poor people do is they tend to steal, because they want to live at the end of the day. They want to have a proper life, just like me and you. So they end up stealing. You have the rates of crimes will go up. You have, for example, murder, as you see that in a lot of developed countries, when there is cities or, I mean, states where there's a high level of poverty, you see the crime rate goes a lot high. For example, in France, they have very high rate of rape. In America, they have a very high rate of rape and murder, and so on and so forth. And when you have countries that are, the majority of citizens are drug dealers, for example, or dealing drugs, obviously because there is, you know, corruption happening. There's poverty, and people want to make a living end, so it drives crimes high. You know, and obviously with the crimes, as we mentioned previously, when a person commits a crime, kill somebody, or there's rape, or there's stealing, you are taking the rights of other people. But then you say, well, but I'm poor. Well, it doesn't justify it. But we say it is one of the causes of corruption is poverty. And poverty does not happen unless the head of the state or the government itself is corrupted to begin with. So these are a few things that we need to understand, that it is a matter of human rights, that corruption should not happen, and the causes of corruption should nevertheless be eliminated in a way or another, whether it's governments, whether it's councils, or whether it's people themselves. They have to do their best to make sure that the society is not corrupted. We leave it up to here. We will continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.